I welcome you back to the very beginning of series number 6 of our Into the Word journey through all of God's inspired Word. We are looking at Genesis chapter number 1 right now, looking at the days of the creation week. And as I already shared with you, I am convinced that the grammar, the word structure of the original Hebrew text indicates that these are literal days. And just to reinforce that, anytime the Hebrew word for day, yom, appears with a number, that's a pretty good indication that it is a specific day. If it appears in conjunction with the words evening and morning, that's a very good indicator that it is a literal day in mind. We actually have all those indicators together here in chapter 1 of Genesis. And so we were working our way through days 1 and 2. And today we want to go to verse number 9 and begin another day where it says this. Well, actually, I want to finish what we started with the second day. God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let dry land appear." And it was so. This seems to me to indicate the idea that there was one singular continent, a supercontinent, if you will, that was created by God out of the liquid matter that is part of planet Earth, which is underneath all of that liquid matter that's stretching out into space to become interstellar space. Sometimes we refer to this as Pangaea, which is an evolutionary scientific term, but it has a place in discussion, even in creationist circles, because there is good evidence for it. It's not that hard looking at all the different continents that exist today to see that they seem to fit back together as one large continent. It's just how quickly and when did that split occur? And spoiler alert, I believe that split occurred during the flood. And we will talk about it at that time. If you want to do some research into what other creationist teaching on this topic of Pangaea, I would certainly recommend that you check out the websites that I was referencing yesterday in our introduction to the book of Genesis. Answersingenesis.org. I know they've got things about Pangaea there on their site. The Institute for Creation Research, their web address is icr.org. They are very scientific in their focus, but they deal with these ideas of the split up of a supercontinent. And then the other one that I mentioned was Discovery Institute. Their website is discovery.org/ID, which has to do with intelligent design. Because remember, Discovery Institute is not promoting biblical treatment of the creationist, evolutionist discussion. They're just basically saying there is something to be talked about the design elements that appear to be part of creation itself. And while I'm not sure that they have dealt with the Pangaea issue, you might find it when you start searching through their material. But back to the text again. Verse number 10 says, God called the dry land, this singular continent, Earth. And land would be probably the idea that we want to take from it here. And the waters that were gathered together, he called seas. Now, it's in the plural. Perhaps because there's a lot of this water, and eventually it does get divided up into multiple seas after the flood. But this water, this salt water, surrounds the dry land where God puts an awful lot of the life that he's about to create, but also the climactic part of that life, which would be humanity. Verse 11, still on this second day, God said, "Let the earth," or the land, "sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth," or on the land. So God is now making the superstructure for life. He provides plants. Plants are there to produce food, but they also are involved in the oxygen carbon dioxide refresh system that is so important to life on this planet. But I do want you to notice that in making these plants, he makes them to reproduce themselves. So he's not going to have to keep on creating. He creates these things to be self-sustaining, that they will be self-replicating. And we have a lot of variety of plants on this world that came about from this original design element of God. Now, they're not all original creations, because there's a lot of subdividing, specialization, or speciation that happened since then. But God made it happen that way, and he did it for our benefit. Verse 12, it was so, and the earth or the land brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to their kind. And God saw that it was good. Now, this is important to see this commentary. When God says, "This is good," he is putting his stamp of approval on it. He's basically saying, "This is the way I wanted it. This is the way I designed it. This is the way I want it to be." Eventually, that goodness is going to be intruded upon by sin. But the book of Genesis is God's big book of beginnings through Moses, and it lets us know how things originally were and what God originally wanted. Verse 13, the thing that we've been looking at, there was evening, there was morning, day number three. So we've had a third, basically 24-hour day period of God putting things into place. Verse 14, God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years." Now, this causes some people some trouble, some consternation, because we've been functioning with a day-night cycle ever since day one, right? Evening, morning. In that first moment, God created light. He says, "Let there be light," and there was light. And apparently there's some sort of rotation that's going on so that there's this light-dark cycle. And actually, the darkness comes first, because evening is always mentioned first in the Jewish way of thinking. Days start at sunset. So where's that light been coming from, if it's not until now that we start seeing the making of the heavenly lights? Well, my answer has to be speculative, because I wasn't there, and Moses didn't give any more detail than this. It could be God being that light, because we know it's mentioned that God is light. But I think it's much more likely that we're talking about something temporary. And the example I usually give is that when you have a building that's being built, it doesn't have electricity at the very beginning. And therefore, it doesn't have the light fixtures in place at the very beginning of the building. So what do these contractors do? What do these construction people do? They bring in temporary lighting. And that's what they use to do their work under until they put in sufficient permanent lighting, and then they remove the temporary lighting. So it might be something as simple as that, that we have been functioning with some sort of temporary lighting arrangement. But in addition to that, I'm going to throw something out for you to check on your own. There is a book that was written quite a few years ago now by a creationist scientist by the name of Dr. Humphrey. The name of the book is Starlight and Time. And Dr. Humphrey theorized that with all of the matter of creation in one spot, in a localized form, remember the big ball of liquid matter that we were talking about to begin with, that would have made this huge gravitational well. And that as God begins to push outward the majority of that material, stretching it out to make the interstellar space, all the different galaxies, that matter going outward starts collapsing the event horizon around the center of where this gravitational field originated. Now, I'm making it very simplistic, and so those of you that are really big-time scientists, you clean it up for the people that you might be talking to, and let me know if there's a way I can express this a little bit better. But basically, outside the event horizon, things pass very quickly as compared to inside the event horizon. So basically, we're looking at 3 days passing already on planet Earth, while millions upon millions of years have passed outside that event horizon. And, of course, light also goes... light is also going to be affected by this gravitational field. Think about the thing where they talk about black holes, which are heavy-duty gravitational sources. And so Dr. Humphrey says that perhaps it was on this day, day number 4, that the gravitational effect, the event horizon, collapsed into our solar system and into planet Earth itself. So that now the light from the stars and the light from the sun and the light from the moon are reaching the surface of planet Earth in real time. And so that is why they are mentioned here on this particular day. Now, is that guaranteed to be what happened? We don't know. But it is some interesting speculation, and I would encourage you to check out Dr. Humphrey's Starlight and Time book. I know it's available on the Answers in Genesis website for sure, and maybe even at icr.org as well. But the reason for these lights are important for the story of the Bible. Back to verse 14, where God says, let them be for signs, meaning something supernatural sometimes, and for seasons, so the passage of time through the year, you know, fall, winter, spring, summer, those can be seen from the placement of the sun and the moon and the stars against the backdrop of space. And let it be for days and years. And that's not that hard because the sun is seen during the day. It's not seen during the night. And so that's one cycle of a day. Evening, morning, day. One day. Same thing with the years. The sun moves back and forth, apparently, in relationship to the sky on the horizon through an entire year as we go around the sun. And originally, it was probably 360 days. And the lunar cycle, where the moon is moving in relationship to the Earth and to the sun, and it goes through its lunar phases, that probably was originally exactly 30 days. And so the lunar cycle provides for the month, which is not mentioned here, but days make up months. And so basically, we have this gigantic clock over our heads that we can use to keep track of the passage of time. And also, God can use it to get our attention for special things. Verse 15, let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens and give light upon the earth. And it was so. God made, and that's past tense, by the way, the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, that would be the sun, and the lesser light to rule the night, which would be the moon, which reflects the light of the sun. And then you throw in the remaining lights of the sky, and that would be the stars, which would also include the star-like effect that planets have from our perspective. They're pinpoints of light up in the sky. Verse number 17, and God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from darkness, and God saw that it was good. Again, exactly as he planned. There's nothing that's gone amiss at all. Everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be and functions perfectly. There was evening, there was morning, day four, fourth day. Verse number 20. God said, let the waters swarm with living creatures. So the waters, particularly that we're focused on here, would be the great big ocean. Now, we'll find out later, there's at least one river that's on the land, and that makes us think there's more than likely plenty of other rivers on the great big supercontinent. And so all of these waters start having life in them of a variety, because God he's basically setting up an ecosystem. A system that can keep itself balanced and provide ongoing life and something to be enjoyed by the epitome of his creation that's coming later, and that would be humanity. So we've got sea creatures, water creatures, and then it says in my English Standard Version, let birds fly across above the earth, across the expanse of the heavens. Now, I'm going to tweak the word birds there. Your footnote, I hope, says something like flyers or flying things, because the word birds is too precise. Because we have bats that fly, don't we? And in the original creation, there were reptiles that flew. So we've got plenty of different winged creatures, and we've got insects galore that have wings as well. So all of those are in this larger category, not just simply birds. And so we've got swimmers and flyers, water creatures, and in the sky creatures. Verse 21, so God created the great sea creatures, This is a very specific subcategory of the things that are in the water. These are big. And the word that gets used here is translated in other places as a serpent. And in some versions of the Bible, including Greek versions, drakon or dragon. And that may, in fact, be something of testimony about how there were these dinosaur creatures, as we call them. Remember, the word dinosaur is a modern invention. It didn't show up, until the 1800s to try to describe some of the creatures that these bones belonged into, that the very beginning of these archaeological digs were finding. But in ancient times, they already had lots of stories and descriptions of very large creatures, both on land and in the water, that were monstrous. Book of Job actually has a couple very good descriptions of them, and we'll talk about it when we get to the Book of Job. But the Hebrew word has an idea of something that's very extended or lengthened, and maybe even segmented. The Greek text, which was translated during the 3rd century BC by people that understood both Hebrew and Greek, they chose a word that had something to do with having a great big mouth. And so it's likely that whales were also in mind for some of these creatures that are in the sea. So God made these great sea creatures, and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm, that would include all the plankton as well, according to their kinds, and every winged creature, every flapper, according to its kind. And what does it say next? God saw that it was good. So it's exactly according to his specifications, exactly according to his design. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, that is, productive, multiply, make more, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the flapping creatures, the flying creatures, multiply on the earth. There was evening. There is morning, day number 5, fifth day. So we now have the environment, land, water, sky. We've got the energy production coming into that environment, the sun, which is also reflecting off the moon, and we've got the stars that are up there as well. And so we've got a time system that can be utilized. Then we have the food source. We have vegetation, both on land and I think in the water as well. And this is taking the energy from the sun and turning it into storage inside its flesh, that is, inside its material. And these can then be eaten by the animals that have been produced, the flying ones, the swimming ones, and that leaves pretty much only the walking ones on land, or the creeping ones on land, which is coming up in our next section. There was verse 24. God said, let the land or the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind. So once again, we get this reminder that God is making this a self-sustaining environment, self-replicating plants, self-replicating animals. Livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. So we're effectively seeing pretty much all of the the land animals that have spinal columns and many of them have four legs or they have four appendages and they breathe and they eat and they reproduce. Some of them are crawling around low. Others are standing up and walking around. And these are all the creatures that will eventually go on to the ark as well. And so we'll keep them in mind. Now, God didn't make tons of different types of dogs. He made one type of dog, which then spread out into all the varieties of wolves and coyotes and all of the different dog kinds today. Same thing with the cats. Same thing with the equine animals. The same thing with all the different varieties. Do you know what a kind is in Scripture? It's easy enough to pin down from a scientific viewpoint. If it can breed and produce offspring, it's part of the same kind. Now, if it produces a non-breeding offspring, that means that you've got two animals that are from far distant parts of that same gene pool. But it still means they're part of that same gene pool. And so evolution doesn't make sense in having something produce something totally different than itself. That's just not the way the world works. But yes, if it's in the same gene pool, it can produce something similar to itself, but which might still be different than it originally was, the two parents, enough that you could describe it in a distinct fashion. And so keep that in mind as we keep talking about the evolutionary creation dispute that goes back and forth. Well, the clock says we're out of time. Come back next time and we'll get back into the Word.